JPMorgan Chase agreed yesterday to pay more than $150 million to settle federal charges. Prosecutors say the bank misled investors about mortgage-related securities it was selling. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The Securities and Exchange Commission said JPMorgan Securities sold a complex mortgage-backed security to a group of institutional investors in 2007, but it allegedly failed to tell the investors that the mortgages underlying the security had been selected by a hedge fund called Magnetar, and Magnetar had shorted some of those mortgages, which means it bet they would fail, says SEC Enforcement Director Robert Kuzami.
In truth, Magnetar Capital played a substantial role in the selection of those mortgage assets and stood to profit from the failure of the assets in the CDO portfolio.
But the SEC says investors were unaware of Magnetar's involvement. The SEC also filed charges against Edward Steffelin, an executive at an investment advisory firm involved in the deal. U.S. officials said Steffelin allowed Magnetar to help select the assets because he was hoping to get a job at the hedge fund. His lawyer said the charges against Steffelin were baffling, and he said his client played no part in the selection of the underlying mortgages. The SEC said investors harmed in the deal will get their money back. JPMorgan Chase agreed to the settlement without admitting any wrongdoing. The $153 million payout represents less than 1% of the bank's net income last year. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Internships have become an important way for young people to get work experience and a foot in the door with a future employer. But now some critics are saying interns are just being exploited for cheap labor, and they're telling young people to ask hard questions about the value of the experience. We'll talk about getting the most from an internship in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to recall an iconic New Yorker magazine cartoon that featured two dogs talking in front of a computer screen. One dog has his paw on the mouse, and he says, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." That 1993 cartoon foreshadowed some news from the internet's blogosphere. In recent days, a 40-year-old married American man admitted to blogging online for months as the widely read gay girl in Damascus. Tom McMaster is his name, and just a few days after that admission, the editor of a blog called lesgetreal.com was revealed to be a 58-year-old retired male Air Force pilot from California. And at one point, the two men had actually communicated online as their assumed identities. And we wondered what would motivate a person to take on such a radically different persona. So we've called Sherry Turkle to talk about this. She's a professor of the social studies of science and technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's also a psychologist. Her latest book is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And she joined us from her home office in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, obviously, one of the reasons we called you is that you've actually been thinking about this for years. You've actually written a number of books talking about the fact that that is one of the things that the online experience allows you to do. So I wanted to start by asking, what have you discovered about why people choose to take on an online identity that's different from their real life identity? And has that changed over the years that you've been thinking about this?
Well, yes and yes. I mean, let's first start with why people do it. There are two important reasons, and the current examples illustrate both. One reason for gender swapping, which is one of the main ways that people do it, or age swapping, when an older person plays a younger person or a younger person plays an older person, is to play with identity, to play with an aspect of self that really is hard to work out in the real. I called it an identity workshop. But there's another aspect, which I think your two gentlemen who took the role of younger lesbians illustrate, and you play with sexuality, which is a very big part of it. I mean, it's not just gender, but people are playing with sexual issues as well. But the second motivation, in addition to having that experience of identity for themselves, is both of these gentlemen wanted to do something that in some way would comment on a social situation. They wanted to say something about being a woman in the Middle East.
Let me play a clip, in fact, from an interview that Tom McMaster, who was previously known as Gay Girl in Damascus, that he did with London's Guardian newspaper about posing as the fictional Amina Araf. Here it is.
What I don't regret is the fact that I did hopefully bring a good bit of attention to real human rights abuses in Syria, the real situation that real people are facing.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is that there are many people who are outraged about this. They are outraged about this in the same way that many people are outraged at, for example, a literary hoax.
Well, what I think the clips and the outrage show, the clip because he's proud of what he performed, and the outrage because people are taking it not as a performance, but as a place where he should not have been performing, but he should have been real, is that we're currently writing the rules of who we're supposed to be when we're online. Now we have Facebook and a whole new idea that when you go online as you.
But on the other hand, though, novelists do this all the time and they're applauded for brilliance. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that we are working through right now as a culture how we are going to have multiple spaces on the internet for all of these different things. When you're getting a report, and I think this is why the Syrian story is so poignant and so important, when you were getting a report about conditions in Syria from this woman in Syria, there's kind of a shock when we're brought up to the reality that, no, for some people, this is a performance space.
And not to finally, before we let you go, not to make you the Miss Manners of the Internet,
right,
but I'm wondering if there was an etiquette that either of these two gentlemen could have followed that would have allowed them to do what they wanted to do without making people feel so betrayed.
Oh, I think I'm going to step away from the Miss Manners of the etiquette, but I think that there's a little bit of a disingenuousness in the Syrian reportage and the way in which those reports say that I raised consciousness about what was happening to women in Syria and be surprised that the people didn't take that as though that were really first-person accounts of a Syrian young woman.
Sherry Turkle is director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. She's the author most recently of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. She was kind enough to take time out from her home office in Provincetown, Massachusetts to talk to us. Professor Turkle, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, a movie that takes a fictional approach to a horrific historical event. In 1937, the Japanese army stormed the Chinese city of Nanking. More than 200,000 people, many of them civilians, were raped and killed. The movie, called City of Life and Death, is opening in some U.S. theaters after causing controversy in both China and Japan. Howie Mofshevitz of Colorado Public Radio spoke with the Chinese man behind the film.
City of Life and Death lives up to its title. In documentary like Black and White, writer-director Lu Chuan shows the systematic murder of thousands of Chinese soldiers. Some machine-gunned, some marched into the sea, some burned, some buried alive. Then the invaders turn to the civilian population, and the process of killing continues. Lu Chuan says he wanted to show that the Japanese had a program for killing.
I really want to show that massacre is just like industry. It's just like a machine, you know. It's used a very complicated program to control the whole machine to eliminate the enemies. So it's just a human being, you know, can design such a complicated program to kill people, you know. It's a very brutal nature.
Lu Chuan interviewed some of the Japanese soldiers who occupied Nanking.
Basically, they don't want to face their memory. But some of them tell me the truth. But I should say, to my surprise, they didn't show any regret. They just say something, but yes, I kill people. Yes, I rape some girls. But, you know, everybody did that, so I have to do that. But they never say sorry. They never feel regret. So for me, it's a very bad experience, you know.
Nevertheless, one of the central characters in City of Life and Death is a sympathetic Japanese soldier. And this turned many Chinese against the film.
This film aroused many, many huge arguments, you know. Lots of the audience, Chinese audience, really hate this movie because I choose the angle of Japanese soldier, you know. The traditional history education give most of the Chinese people a feeling that Japanese people are beasts, They're not a human being, just like us. So in my movie, I show the humanity of a Japanese soldier. So the Chinese audience cannot accept it.
Lu Chuan got death threats. Still, a lot of people went to see the film in China. One reason Lu shows the innate decency of the Japanese soldier is to create a complex portrait of human behavior instead of an indictment of one nation or culture. Richard Pena, program director of the Film Society of Lincoln Center, says that City of Life and Death really includes three points of view: that of Japanese soldiers, the Chinese in Nanking, and the observations of Westerners in the city displayed on postcards as they chronicled the invasion.
I think a lot of it has to do with the notion of witnessing. I mean, if there's one concept that I think really unites the aesthetic principle of the film, it is that of witnessing. And, you know, for a long time under the People's Republic, it was practically forbidden to talk about because it was seen really in many ways as a symbol of Chinese weakness. The fact that so few Japanese had been able to terrorize, humiliate, and murder so many Chinese was seen in an uncomfortable light. So this film offers, you know, in ways that some people support and some people don't, a kind of varied position on it. And I think in the end, the idea that films like this are made, and made in such a way that really not only, how could you say, excite emotions, but incite thought, incite reflection, incite meditation, that's what's great. And that gives you hope. That gives you hope that we're, you know, we're better than that was.
For filmmaker Lu Chuan, the shifting points of view, the surprises and ambiguities in his film are central to the story he wants to tell. He's made a violent war film because he hates violence and war. And he made a film in which one group of people brutalizes another to show that all people are capable of both horror and remorse.
I think everybody is the Japanese soldier. Everybody is Japanese soldier. You know, in our heart, there's several kinds of desires. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. But in the war, the desire which can push us to do bad things comes out.
Besides Japanese soldiers who'd been in Nanking, Lu Chuan talked to Chinese survivors. He read journals and diaries, and he even made a trip to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., to see how the killing in Europe is remembered. He says that what he saw through the making of City of Life and Death did not comfort him.
During the process making this movie, I felt I'm open many, many doors. The door towards the darkness of the heart, you know. So every day I'm open the door and go deeper and deeper to the soul of humanity. So I feel sometimes I was scared. I'm really scared, you know.
Yet what's most surprising about City of Life and Death is that after all of the horror and fear, some people find the strength to go on. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofsovitz.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Over the years, The Onion, the satirical newspaper, has broken some big stories. My favorite of all time was The Onion's story that the U.S. Congress was threatening to leave Washington for the suburbs if it didn't get a new building with more parking, luxury skyboxes, and a retractable dome. That story, like several other Onion scoops, was picked up as real news, in that case by a newspaper in Beijing. As a recent ad in The Onion puts it, there have been more than 8,000 Pulitzer Prizes awarded since 1917. Isn't it about time The Onion received one? That is from the Americans for Fairness in Awarding Journalism Prizes, and the AFAJP has some powerful supporters.
Hi, I'm Arianna Huffington.
Hey there, I'm Ira Glass.
Hello, I'm Tom Hanks. Thank you.
If The Onion does not receive a Pulitzer, I will make sure that every link on the Huffington Post goes directly to the Columbia Journalism School website and cripples it.
You already have an entire category for editorial cartooning. Isn't The Onion better than that? And not still mired in the aesthetics of the year 1760 like apparently all of you are?
Who gather annually in what must be some all-night drunken bacchanalia slash pinata party, the result of which is the awarding of the prize Pulitzer.
Well, joining us now to talk about the campaign for The Onion to receive a Pulitzer Prize is Will Tracy, Associate Editor of The Onion. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And why does The Onion deserve a Pulitzer?
Well, the way I see it, we've accomplished pretty much everything that can be accomplished. I think we are the most dominant force in journalism right now. I think we bring in more ad revenue than any other paper or radio show or television show. The one thing that we have not accomplished so far is won a Pulitzer Prize. And in my mind, it comes down to a simple prejudice that the Pulitzer Board has against The Onion.
Now, The Onion bills its current issue as the 1,000th issue. By the way, the 1,000th issue, and that ad says more than 8,000 Pulitzer Prizes have been awarded.
That's right.
These numbers, you've actually checked these out, these rounded up, let's say?
Record-keeping generally is not a big virtue at The Onion. It's not one of our main skills. But from what we can tell, give or take a few thousand, I think that's how many Pulitzer Prizes have been awarded. And in terms of the 1,000 issues, we think we know it's summer 2011, and we think it's June-ish.
Currently, you have such stories as, I'm just reading the headlines, Angela Merkel opens up to the only newspaper she trusts. The work you do is so important. That's to The Onion. Police find missing journalistic excellence in Onion newsroom.
Yes.
And previous Pulitzer winners say, feel so hollow knowing there are far more deserving institutions.
And I appreciate them saying that. Obviously, they're not going to give their Pulitzer Prizes back. I think they should. But I appreciate at least acknowledging the fact that we deserve it more than they do.
What do you think is The Onion's best category here for a Pulitzer?
You know, it can come in a lot of forms, really. I mean, I think we would also take whatever they're giving out. I think it could be national journalism. I think it could be breaking news. I think we'd also accept one of those special awards and citations like Bob Dylan got.
You know, humorists have been awarded prizes for commentary, and I believe Onion TV won a Peabody Award.
Yes, we did.
Not too long ago. So
yes.
This is more realistic than the Congress moving off to suburban Virginia, say.
It's not unprecedented. And in fact, I think we were told after the 2008 election, somebody suggested that we submit. And so we actually have submitted. Apparently, we didn't enclose enough money with our submission or something because we never really heard back. And I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe we were supposed to wash Thomas Friedman's car or something. I'm not sure what it takes at this point.
I'm trying to imagine what the Onion headline would be if you actually did win a Pulitzer.
Well, I don't think there would be a headline because I think the day that we would receive a Pulitzer, I think we would pretty much shut down everything for a good while so we could just have time to gloat.
Well, Will Tracy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Will Tracy, Associate Editor of The Onion. There was a vote yesterday on the individual mandate, the provision of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the Democratic health care plan, that says people have to buy health insurance or pay a penalty. The vote was 326 in favor of still supporting the individual mandate and 165 opposed. It was not a legislature that took that vote. It was the House of Delegates of the American Medical Association, which reaffirmed the position it took in favor of mandating coverage back in 2006. Joining us to talk about that and also about other issues the doctors are concerned about is Dr. Cecil Wilson, who is the outgoing president of the AMA and who's in Chicago. Welcome to the program once again.
Well, thank you so much.
First, which is the more appropriate message to read in that vote, that AMA delegates support the individual mandate 2-1, or that as many as a third are opposed and you had to have a vote in the first place?
Well, I think the message is that two-thirds of the delegates in the House reaffirmed AMA policy, which was put in place back in 2006 before health system reform was even on many people's radar screens. And I think it's important to note that during the intervening 5 years, there is still no evidence that we can achieve the kind of coverage that we think is important for the American people without people who can pay for it assuming that responsibility.
Without everyone anteing up.
Absolutely.
You know how contentious this is, and there are legal challenges to the mandate. Will the AMA file a friend of the court brief in support of the individual mandate?
The AMA will not file a friend of the court brief. We do not see that as our role. We see our role as influencing legislation and as establishing this policy. We believe that there are others, certainly in the federal government, who will be defending that law, and we will follow that very closely.
Let me bring you to another issue of concern for the doctors in the Congress. Every year, doctors in the Congress have been going through the same routine over Medicare reimbursement rates. And since the cuts that are actually called for by law in those rates have usually been averted by Congress, the amount that doctors are scheduled to be cut by each year rises each year to the point where you now, in theory, face a 29% cut in Medicare reimbursements. Inevitably, doctors end up being spared that cut or getting some small increase. If you threw out that whole system, how could the country decide how to compensate doctors for treating Medicare patients without overpaying them or without underpaying them?
Yeah. the problem with that system is the way it was set up has just not worked, and it has put physicians in the position of being threatened every year, and each time those cuts were delayed, the potential for cuts went even higher.
Yes, they mount with each year, but except for 2002, they've never actually been implemented in any recent year, so...
But the lack of an adequate increase to cover the cost of providing care means at this point physicians are paid some 19% lower than they would have been if the payments had responded to just the rise in inflation. And to your other point, and that is, what is the alternative? The AMA has suggested an approach, and that is, one is to get rid of this formula. The second is to put in place 5 years of stable payments that have an increase to reflect the cost of providing care, and during that 5 years to study alternative delivery and payment models to encourage efficiency and at the same time preserving quality.
But relative to what Americans make typically, doctors are extremely well paid in our country, and is that part of the equation that's going to have to be altered in coming years if the whole healthcare economy is returned to something we can afford?
Well, first of all, doctors are valued in this country, and we are most appreciative of that. What we're talking about, though, is access for the patients. And so if part of that physician's practice, which is Medicare, is not paid enough to be able to make that work, that is to pay salaries, to buy equipment, to turn the lights on, then it's going to be patients who suffer for that. And there's not a way to solve our problems of cost for Medicare by cutting payments to physicians. What that will do is actually decrease access to care, because physicians will have to change the mix of patients that they see.
Well, Dr. Wilson, thank you very much for talking to us. You talked to us shortly after you became president of the AMA, and now just as you're leaving office at the AMA. So thanks a lot once again.
Well, thank you, and it's my pleasure.
That's Dr. Cecil Wilson, who is the outgoing president of the American Medical Association.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.